Our Fireside Economics Chat here at The Economist.
Hi guys, this is Jayant here.
And we are here, Jayant, about a very special episode, about 10 years. I mean, this was one of those events where whether you were interested in finance or not, whether you were related to finance or not, you heard the headlines.
It was a manic Monday in the financial markets. The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend. Lehman Brothers, a 158-year-old firm, down by bad mortgage investments, Lehman, which has 25,000 employees, will be liquidated.
After that, the entire economic world went into a tailspin. This is like one of those JFK getting shot moments that everybody remembers where they were when the news broke. So we'll begin with you, Jayant. Where were you at when the news broke?
Well, I was in your class, if you remember.
Okay, so run us through that day from the time you got that fateful SMS from Money Control. Remember, these are times when smartphones are not really a thing yet.
Yeah, so I just started tracking stock markets. So someone just gave me the website Money Control, and I was running a fancy league there. So basically, running the competition wherein you play with the fake money but real stock prices. So to get the market news, you give your phone number and they send you the market report at the end of the day, or if any important news break which used to come. So this is way before breaking news. So I got this SMS just before your class began, and probably you can add what happened next.
Okay, so Jayant comes to me with this news, and I was supposed to take a special session on the Indian financial system, actually, with a combined set of students from India and Germany. There was visiting students from Hochschule Neu-Ulm University in Germany. And it was Jayant's MBA class, which was the other half of that Indo-German joint session that I was supposed to be taking. And Jayant runs to me about, what, half an hour before the presentation? I mean, the
yes.
class is scheduled to begin, and he says that the news has broken, that Lehman Brothers has just collapsed, and financial markets have gone into a tailspin, and people are talking about deep recession coming and so on. We immediately downloaded the CNN report. We tried to make sense of what was going on, and we led the class with that. I actually went into the class in the first half an hour in giving people the background and the explanation of what was happening and why we thought would turn out to be something crucial. And our intuition was right. It turned out to be something whose effects are still being felt today, 10 years on. They will be probably felt another 10 years later. Change the course of our careers and our lives, sort of impact your academic career in a sense.
Major repercussion was not felt yet because we were far away from the action, but it hit the fan after 6 months during my thesis days. I was going and getting these questionnaires filled about my thesis topic was managing high net worth individuals' money, where do they put in their investments and all. So I had a couple of wealth management MNC companies where I was doing the survey and getting to know how about the investor psychology. This questionnaire done and everything was ready. Just before the final thesis submission, I have to get the approval letter that I have done the, I've taken key inputs from them, and I go there in month of 2009 and in South Park term, they're gone.
And they were gone. Of course, we all know what happened next. There was some serious repercussions from then on. The Indian economy was very directly or dramatically affected, but there were subtle changes that are being felt. And Jayant, what we're going to do for our listeners in this episode is try to break down this seismic and highly complex event into parts of why and how this has affected interest in the world of finance. I mean, Lehman Brothers was not a bank who people had heard of. You and I may have heard of it because we were finance at that time. I was teaching economics and finance at that. Naturally, we had to be in the know of these things, but few of your classmates probably did not know what or who else. A majority of our students in the class did not know it either. So our objective in this episode is going to be to sort of examine the legacy of this event and try to relive it through some of the actors who were there right in front of lines when the action was unfolding, if you could call it that. Like we were saying before the podcast, that should we call it celebrating the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis, or should we call it commemorating? Because whatever way you look at it, it's an amazing event. And Where better to start than Absolute Ground Zero?
Hi everyone, I'm Radhika Gupta. I'm currently CEO of Edelweiss Asset Management, our mutual fund business, and I've been doing this for the last 2 years. I'm an investment professional actually by background, and you know, interestingly, we are coming up on celebrating the 10th anniversary of Lehman Brothers and the whole financial crisis. With our markets correcting a little bit, there's been a lot of conversation about whether we're in a 2008-like situation. So not going there, but a lot of conversation about the financial crisis. Interestingly, you know, I'm just dialing back 10 years. So 10 years ago, on September 14th, 2008, Lehman Brothers actually went under. That was the day of my birthday, so I can't forget that day at all. It was interestingly the day I turned 25. So I will never forget the 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis. When the financial crisis happened, I was on Wall Street in the thick of the action. I was actually at a hedge fund called AQR Capital, very large hedge fund then. When I joined AQR, just to share a few stories with you, it was a $40 billion firm. I joined them as a portfolio manager, so I was looking at various portfolios. I was actually looking at mortgage-backed securities then, which for those of you who know the financial crisis, was at the thick of the financial crisis. And after I had graduated from Wharton, obviously times were very, very good. I mean, we went through 2005, 6, 7, and things were absolutely outstanding. I mean, portfolios were going, funds were doing well. It was just great across the board. The financial crisis happened in March 08. Obviously, Bear Stearns went on under, Lehman went under, and the fund I ran, the $40 billion fund I ran, actually became a $20 billion fund within a year. And I saw this relatively young in my career as a portfolio manager. And, you know, one of the more interesting things of the financial crisis is that all the assumptions that you had about markets changed suddenly in a crisis. So what you thought was a safe counterparty to do trading with became suddenly not okay. Your assumptions about how much markets could move in a day suddenly changed manifold because the crisis kind of exposed us to numbers and realities that we had never even studied in a textbook. You know, it was the big 3 sigma events, 4 sigma events, 6 sigma events, 9 sigma events. All that suddenly became a reality. As I said, a crisis in economic terms also brings crisis in lots of other ways. So you see crisis from an employee front. Obviously, at AQR, we started, trimming. Wall Street started downsizing. Clients came to us with a lot of questions. So a lot of things happened in that crisis. Incidentally, I went back to AQR Capital this year, marking 10 years. I left the firm in 2009, and I went back this year in May just to see how things were. Some of you may be curious to know that that $40 billion firm that became $20 billion is actually now a $200 billion asset manager.
Yes.
And I think that's my first great lesson from a crisis.
What Radhika was telling, this event didn't happen all of a sudden. It's not like Turkey was butchered on a Thanksgiving just like that. It was well fed all through the year before it was butchered. So there were a couple of guys who were sounding the putting out the warning signs out there. So one was, of course, our rock star, former central banker, Raghuram Rajan.
The other was Dr. Doom himself, Nouriel Roubini.
Then there was third person.
And that's the person we went to talk to.
I'm Saurabh Mukherjee. I'm the founder of Marcellus Investment Managers. We are a PMS license, and we're hoping to manage Indian high net worth portfolios in our traditional style of focusing on companies with clean accounting, sensible capital allocation, and proven track records of building a cash generator franchise. But let me talk about my previous life in the UK. And in 2003, when I was 27 years old, I founded a firm in London called Clear Capital. And it was a small and mid-cap research house wherein we would call up the British fund managers, the fidelities and the capitals of the world, and we would give them investment ideas. And in return, they would they would direct trades towards us. So age of 27, I embarked upon being a financials analyst. I was, other than being the founder of Clear Capital, I was also in charge of the financial services sector. And through the course of 2007, I became a fairly prominent, highly rated financials analyst in the UK. But where the great financial crash of 2008 entered my life was in January 2007, I remember still very, very clearly, it was a crisp winter's morning in January 2007. I went for our monthly chat with our chairman, John Kay. John Kay, the former Financial Times columnist, the author of Other People's Money, and so the main intellectual influence on my life. He was our founding chairman. He was also the seed investor in Clear Capital. And during our monthly chat, that faithful January 2007 chat, John's penetrating intellect helped me understand how the UK financial system would blow up. And it was quite, you know, one of those meetings in your life, I'll never forget. It was a cup of tea, and by the time I finished the cup of tea, it was very, very clear in our head how the system would blow up. 2 February 2007, we wrote our first 40-pager on how the crisis would play out. And it was a note called Risk Amplifiers on Full Volume. It was a note on UK non-bank lenders, UK NBFCs. Anybody who buys an Indian NBFC should read that Jan 2007 note called Risk Amplifiers on Full Volume, where we explained how the system had become overly geared, how the banks had lent to each other, how CDOs, CLOs were a ticking time bomb, and how underlying credit quality in the UK mortgage market was sinking. So February, March, April, May, June 2007, I remember we wrote several such notes about how the system would blow up. I remember doing at least 3 conferences in the city of London through the spring and summer of 2007. And by summer 2007, the crash, the beginnings of the crash started playing out. HSBC became the first of the big banks to warn about their US mortgage business. I think one of the French banks had a fund which blew up in the summer of 2007. And by September 2007, it was clear that something serious was afoot. The meltdown hadn't started, but stock prices of lenders started correcting. By December 2007, I started looking for a buyer for my own firm, for Clear Capital, because I figured out that if the financial system would blow up, my small UK, small and mid-cap research boutique, co-founded with a few colleagues, would also suffer. And we started looking for buyers. That search continued through the spring of 07, spring of 08, and March 08, Westerns blew up. And by the time I sold my firm in May 08, it was already clear that something very serious was afoot. So after selling my firm in May 08, I migrated to India. I think it was the day before the first IPL final, 13th or 14th May 08. And to my astonishment, upon landing in Mumbai, I encountered several people, seasoned investors, who held on to this notion that somehow India was decoupled from the global financial system.
Spoiler alert, it wasn't.
Because this crisis was the first time that the lines between Wall Street or Dalal Street or the stock market and Main Street, that is the common person, began to blur. Because people began to take the issue of how their money was being managed or what was happening to their money very seriously.
So my name is Eric Balchunas. I am a senior ETF analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence, which is the research division of Bloomberg. My main focus here is to cover, write about, talk about, and analyze exchange-traded funds, but that bleeds into index funds, mutual funds, and occasionally derivatives. But largely, that's my job here.
If all that sounded a lot of Greek and Latin to you, let Jen explain what Eric was talking about.
So there are two ways in which money are managed. The first one is the most traditional way, wherein you go give your part of your money to someone who actively manages, which is basically a portfolio manager who buys and sells based on his knowledge about the market. Then there is a simpler way wherein you'd simply go buy the index. You just track the index. So that is what an index fund is.
So during the crisis, and especially after it, this question of who's managing my money and how are they managing it and why does it matter became very, very crucial.
And I've been doing my work in BI for 2 years, but before that I was in Bloomberg's data division for 15 years. And in that division I basically looked after the data of ETFs, making sure the Bloomberg terminal had all the correct data. So I'm really, I'm a communications major and I have a background in that. But my, you know, last almost 2 decades were spent as a data nerd. And so my job now is kind of a merger of the two. I spend a lot of time in the data and then I come out of that hole and talk about it and communicate it, both in my writing, a TV show and a podcast, as well as some other, you know, events. I work with our clients. And that's basically my world in a nutshell. So I was in Bloomberg's Princeton office, and I was, again, working in data. And it's interesting, you know, in 2008, because I wasn't covering anything or writing about the industry, my memory is a little fuzzy. Of course, I remember 2008 as a person and an investor, and there was a political race here in the U.S. going on that was just really, it was a lot of news.
Yeah, everything happening simultaneously.
Yeah, it was a crazy, it was the autumn of 2008 was really just wild. But as my job, I wasn't there like, you know, interviewing Morgan Stanley or writing about the ups and downs of the market. I was just making sure data was being put into the terminal correctly so that when you typed up SPY on the Bloomberg terminal, you saw the shares outstanding, the NAV, the assets. I also worked on building new functions. So my job was much more making sure all the data was right, not so much interpreting what was going on in the market. My job's a little more like that now. So mm-hmm. back then, that's all I did. And so to a degree, I had my head in the sand. Beyond just being a human being, you know, who was concerned about the market. And of course, I remember how it all seemed to, it was surreal, you know, that a lot of these companies were imploding. So I experienced it mostly like everybody else. If it were to happen today, I would have a whole different experience because I'd be writing night and day about how ETFs are affected, what the next move might be. You know, I would be much more sensitive to it. So that's where I was 10 years ago, sort of in my own little data world.
Okay. So you cover a lot of investment on passive side, which is basically ETF, and you also have written a book on it. So how has the investment world post-crisis, the passive side of investments have taken a huge stride compared to the active? So how has the investment world evolved over the last decade?
A couple things. I think, and the word that keeps coming up for me is disillusionment. I think 2008 made a lot of investors disillusioned to everything. Wall Street, active managers, the whole thing just stunk to them. And, you know, we, as an ETF analyst, I look at 2008 as the year that made ETFs and really put passive investing on the map. A lot of investors found that their active mutual fund did not outperform. Two-thirds of them failed to beat the benchmark. And so what we saw in 2008 was the beginning of a move to passive. In addition, ETFs were, you know, in 2008, there was a lot of things that lost liquidity. ETFs remain liquid. In fact, they got more liquidity. They traded $25 trillion worth of shares that year. That's still to this day the most they've ever traded. So ETFs became a liquid vehicle in a time of illiquidity. And so the ETFs ended up getting traders. ETFs ended up making fans out of traders who liked the liquidity. and realized that ETFs could take a beating. I mean, there was some rough days and they still tracked the index and everything went fine. That brought the institutions and traders around. And then the retail investor came around to ETFs because they just saw they weren't getting much, or they were doing even worse than the market in this active fund, which they were paying 1% for. So that was the year both traders and retail, I think, even more so, came into the ETF world. So from my perspective, that's what 2008 did. But on the retail front, you can't underestimate the disillusionment of that year and how it created a new mindset of investors, which is, you know, and advisors. I think a lot of them just don't think that you can beat the market on an extended period of time. I think some institutions still do to a degree, but that is the single biggest driver of passive flows. So since then, since 2008, passive funds now in the U.S. have $6.5 trillion, and they might have had, you know, a couple hundred billion back then, you know, or maybe a trillion. It was not much. So they grew a lot, and most of that growth was organic flows. To me, that was probably the biggest change since then. And obviously, QE and the Fed helped the market kind of go up in this nice, steady path. And that also, I think, made it even harder for active managers to beat the benchmark, because the S&P 500 and even other world benchmarks like the MSCI EAFE or the emerging markets, the central bank and then providing liquidity and buying bonds really helped the market go up in a nice, steady pattern. And, you know, when you're a market cap weighted index like the S&P, that means you kind of have a little momentum. So active had a difficult time in 2008 avoiding the crisis. And they've since then had a difficult time beating the S&P 500 because it's had such a nice cruise up. So you really, both of those things together have changed the whole mentality of investors, in my opinion. And for the most part, stock picking has been tough because everything's kind of just gone up.
So basically, the one way up market, which less volatile, has made passive investment more lucrative in terms of, rather than its stock picking or active management.
Say it one more time, sorry.
So basically, the low, less drawdowns and the one way streak of the market post crisis has helped passive guys to attract more inflows in the ETF
yes.
side of the business.
Because the S&P, what is it up, like an average of 16% every year since the crisis, something like that? I mean, you know, unless you were an active manager who picked Amazon and Google and did nothing else, you're probably lost to the S&P. And if you can get the S&P 500 in an index fund for 3 or 4 basis points, then you're getting every ounce of that return up. So even an active manager that would have beat the S&P by, I don't know, 50 basis points, gross of fees, net of fees, they probably trailed it anyway. Plus you add in the transaction costs from the trading of the portfolio, and they probably have 2% they have to overcome each year. And so, yeah, it's made it more difficult, not to mention the fact that a lot of the market has just moved up as a whole, right? But even with that, even there has been some areas of volatility where you could argue, oh, it's more of a stock picker's market, so to speak. Those really haven't done much. And the bigger problem is, okay, fine, it's a stock picker's market. But I think some investors are just like, hey, but how do I know I'm going to pick the right stock picker? What if they pick the wrong stocks at the wrong time?
As the jitters were felt in the developed countries, the pressure was felt here also, basically on the wealth management side of the business. So we went and spoke to Nawai Lavlaki of International Money Matters.
So if you go back to 10 years ago, I think we get to the crisis. Before we get to the crisis, we have to look at 2007.
Yeah.
And in India, for me, I was a founder of Money Matters, which then in 2001, which became International Money Matters in 2005. And we were in the business of financial planning and investment advisory services and wealth management. So 2007 was sort of virtually the peak of a bull run that was running for the last 4 years in India. And we had a lot of investors who were cribbing in August, September 2007, because they had given us checks for investing in equity, and we were feeling that something was not right. So we wanted to sort of slow down, but the markets kept rallying. And there were times I recall where investors, you know, were really upset that for 2 months we were holding the checks and the market had gone up 10-12% in 2 months' time towards the latter half of 2007. And because we probably didn't have experience of this sort of type of crisis, we obviously had no sense that the magnitude of the crisis that was sort of unfolding. We finally succumbed sometime in November, December 2007 and actually invested money for clients which we were saying no to from August, September. And 1 month later, the clients were telling us, see, you know, we got it right because the market had gone up a further 10% from that level. Then the fall started. When the fall started, actually within the first 2-3 weeks, we had a couple of days of circuit breaker and the market sort of falling 10-20% at that time. And we felt, oh, if the markets were good to invest probably a month ago, month and a half ago, now we are back at the same level, so we should continue investing. So we actually did nothing different in January of 2008 when the first sort of falls happened. But a couple of months down, sometime in April, we actually stopped making any lump sum investments in equity for clients. We said SIPs are fine, we should continue those, but lump sums, let's not do that. Things don't seem to be too correct and right. One month probably later, I think it was mid-May, Bear Stearns almost collapsed, just sort of survived from the brink. I recall that we sent out a newsletter to our clients, a communication to everyone, somewhere in the third week of June, saying that we are recommending that you cut 35% of your equity exposure. And of course, some of the clients did challenge and say, if you are not, we didn't do it at 21,000 10x levels, then, you know, why are we trying to do it at 16,000, 17,000? I think it was in that range at that time. And we had to try and explain and tell the clients why we thought so. Some of them agreed. Some said, no, don't think so. Some said, oh, we'll do much less. But for a lot of clients, I think 35% cut did happen. Now, why 35? Hindsight. We can say that we should have done 65, but we definitely as planners didn't want to do 100% out. But we just said that you cut this exposure. Thereafter, of course, you know, things started unfolding 2-3 months later when the Lehman Brothers collapse and many other things were looking like, you know, they are down out. Too big to fail was just a term which just didn't sting true. So somewhere in October 2008, October, November, and the markets were sort of falling very, very rapidly, October, I think it was. One thing we definitely decided was that we had to communicate a lot more. So we started talking to our investors wherever possible in small groups, wherever possible one-on-one. In fact, I remember a day when I went to Mumbai to meet clients. I met one client at her residence, then I met about four of them together at a barista because they knew one another. And then I had two sessions in the evening at my home where about 20-25 people each came in two batches. And we just went through to try and explain to them what the crisis was, what this collateral debt chakkar was, what it means, and so on and so forth.
Oh, nice. So basically you did a big shot movie trying to simplify the complicated finance jargons in the client.
Yeah, we just felt that, yeah, we had to just talk to them. So I remember sitting in the hall in my room and, you know, typical Mumbai house where, you know, it's a one bedroom flat. So in the hall I was sitting down and I had a laptop turned around, projector and all, and I was trying to show them some things on the laptop and talk to them. And like I said, there were 2 days of maybe 1.5 hour we had slotted. And the previous batch was still going on when the next slot came in and they started asking questions. So I had to actually tell them to stop. You don't know what the background is. So I have not yet explained that background.
Okay.
Once I explain that background, then, you know, you ask questions.
Okay.
So I know we did that and that sort of helped talking to clients. There were a couple of actions we took thereafter. One, we said that we don't know whether the market is at bottom, but if it is not at bottom, it will soon be at bottom and definitely it's close to bottom. But one conversation I remember with that group that I did as a barista, one of the clients was really very jittery, and at that time there was a talk of even liquid funds failing in India.
Yes, yes, yes.
So she was very perturbed. She said, you know, I have this money in this cash management plan and, you know, what should I do? So I said, if you're feeling so jittery, let's redeem. Let the money come in your bank and you sit with it. She said, okay, fine. So we, next day we redeemed the money. The following day she called me and she sounded a little panicky. So I said, yeah, what happened? She said, no, the money has come.
Hmm.
So I said, yeah, so it's a liquid fund. You know, it is T+1. It comes the next day. She said, oh, I redeemed because I didn't expect the money to come.
Oh, okay.
So now what should I do with this? So I said, nothing. You know, nothing has changed between day before yesterday and today. Just let's sit with the money. You know, we'll decide. You know, let things calm down. If you are feeling jittery, that just because this money has come back doesn't mean your anxiety has come down or markets, you know, things have changed. Dramatically. Wait with it and we'll see, you know, later on. So that was our experience. And I remember a lot of my clients asking my team members when they had joined and they were interacting with some of the clients. Some of the smarter clients actually asked them saying, how many bear markets have you seen?
Hmm.
And some of them who were youngsters said, you know, what's a bear market? You know, I've only seen markets going one way.
Clearly, managing investor expectations and understanding and managing their psychology was the biggest challenge that came out of this entire exercise. Because crises usually shake people out of their complacency, out of their very predictable or stable worldview, because they realize that things can change in an instant. So 10 years on, what have we exactly learned? Or like they say in Gogogon.
So what do we know? What have we learned?
You know, Winston Churchill said this. He said, when you're going through hell, the most important thing is just to get through. And I always tell people this in a correction, that in any kind of crisis, at that moment, at that day, when you see the screen is red, and this is true of our personal lives as well, you think, God, this is never going to end, this is so bad, this is so stressful. But every crisis tides over. I mean, it has a point where it gets to a low. And then I remember in 2009, things started improving, and they improve and they improve. And when you look at things over a 10-year horizon, 40 went to 20 and 20 went to 200. So I think the best lesson from a crisis is just get through it. I think from a financial point of view, one of the things to keep in mind, one of the greatest lessons from the financial crisis, whether you were in the US or India, is that don't make mistakes. I think the investing business has always been talked about, unfortunately, with a lot of swagger in terms of market returns, multi-baggers, great portfolios. Every time we have a crisis, you realize that so much about investing is just not making mistakes. You know, I think crisis just gave us a chance. I mean, so to give you my history, we actually left the U.S. in April 2009 to found Forefront. And I guess, you know, tough times always force you to ask very existential questions. In fact, when I came back to India, we had survived the financial crisis, you know. My partner and I, we had kept our jobs despite the layoff. So the family was like, are you crazy? Why are you moving back? You survived when a lot of people have got layoffs. But I mean, I think it forces you to ask existential questions. And you always think, can I do more? You know, can I use this as a chance to do something else? So I think there's not an explicit role, but there's an implicit role. I think what's more important is crisis has played a very sharp role in how I built Forefront Capital and how we run Edelweiss AMC today, and broadly Edelweiss Finn also, I think the culture of risk management, one of our guiding principles is that be risk conscious. And that comes out of having seen a crisis early in the career.
In the past 10 years, we were not affected that directly, what happened with the global crisis, because of a stellar job by our central bankers and other financial institutions. But of late, what kept us rock solid during the crisis has gone down over the past 3 to 4 years. That's our PSUs, which helped us out during the crisis. So Saurav will throw more light into it.
If you look at the Indian financial system today, it's unquestionably more fragile and more vulnerable than it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we had a strong banking system, which had PSU banks with quasi-sovereign guarantees accounting for the bulk of the system's loan book. We had small but healthy NBFCs. And whilst I think one of them, Cholamandalam, did face a liquidity crunch during Lehman, overall it was a well-regulated financial system, with the RBI having done a stellar job of insulating Indian financial system from a meltdown. If you look at India today, the share of the PSU banks has obviously been decimated. Their balance sheets have been decimated. Even amongst the private sector lenders, lenders with wholesale market funded balance sheets, CD market, CP market funded balance sheet, account for the lion's share of lending. So we've created a financial system where the funding of the economy primarily comes from the CD and the CP market, from the money market, right? And whether these are banks, whether they are NBFCs, housing finance companies, these entities are by design levered 9, 10, 11 times. So they're borrowing in the wholesale market, giving 3-year loans for trucks and cars, and giving 20-year loans for homes. The credit quality of these loans have steadily been compromised as competition has intensified, especially in housing finance. The credit rating that these loans attract are as optimistic as the credit ratings doled out by the rating agencies in America and UK in 2007-2008. We are replaying the same thing all over again in India. I think what's happened is the corporate treasuries and sort of retired people have got sucked into heavily putting money into liquid funds and money market funds. I think they're called in America and India, they're called liquid funds. Corporates parking surplus capital there, nothing wrong with that. It's far for the course. But my reading is a lot of the liquid fund flows have come from households, right? Households were looking for yield.
Yeah.
And as if you look at the 3-month CP, it hit around 12% in September 13, and then I think it bottomed out to around 6% in July 2017. That drop in yield resulted in a rise in the prices of commercial paper, right? Because as yield drops, price. And that period, right, I think resulted in a lot of people getting pulled into liquid funds. In the last 12 months, basis AMFI data, my reading is, AMFI data shows that liquid funds are seeing outflows over the last 12 months. But the enthusiasm of elderly retirees and those seeking yields, their enthusiasm for NCDs, non-convertible debentures issued by NBFCs, HFCs, and for CPs is very strong, and my reckoning is a lot of this troublesome paper is getting parked with these more vulnerable constituencies. Now I actually tried to get the relevant powers that be to intercede and say that look, these NCDs and CPs are being given ridiculously high credit ratings, but as I guess the people in America would have found in 07, my pleas have fallen on deaf ears, and we continue to see steady stream of very highly rated paper getting whacked out by wholesale market funded lenders. And the concern is that vulnerable constituencies in our country are buying this paper via the mutual fund houses. Mutual fund houses are running these money market funds, these liquid funds, but the buyers of the units our vulnerable constituency. So this is going to be very interesting to watch as to what happens if we have more episodes like ILFS.
Yeah.
If we have episodes like ILFS, what will happen to the NAV value of these units that the money market funds hold? It'll be very interesting to watch.
A crisis like this is usually a life-changing event, like we were discussing at the top of the podcast, Jayant. Things changed for us personally as well. We got more interested in economics and finance.
Yes,
of course,
very much.
We went on to be involved with those in academic capacity, in industry capacity, and so on. But what this crisis really did was, in a general sense, it blew down that wall that was between Wall Street and Main Street, as they say, that the person, the common person on the street versus the people who were interested or invested in the stock market, like you were as a student who was interested in tracking the stock market because you were playing that game, or I was because I was teaching those subjects. But otherwise, people used to think, well, finance, stock markets, high-end economics, those are other people's problems. They are not their problems.
Like they say it in the movie Simpsons, it's China's problem.
But this really no longer remained somebody else's problem, or to use the Simpson terminology, it's not China's problem any longer, because thanks to this crisis, it meant everybody had been affected. Because I was at the London School of Economics attending a course on the economic crisis, and one of the points one of the professors made was that this was a crisis for banking systems where some people faced crisis of liquidity, that is, they had assets but they could not convert them into liquid cash and thus they were stuck, and some others faced the problem of solvency, which is why a lot of them went under. The banks like Lehman Brothers, for example, closed, and this had ripple effects throughout the rest of the economy. The only thing we can probably say in terms of legacy, Jayant, is we can tell people that they need to be more aware or conscious.
Yes, they better be ready.
Okay, so a 40-minute podcast is probably not enough for us to talk about the different aspects of this crisis. How did it happen, and what were the other actors in there, and what kind of real-world impact it had? We are unfortunately so limited for time. But that doesn't stop us, Jayant, from giving people a bit of a handle on things that they can go read or watch to explore more about the crisis if they want to, just like how we did over the years as we realized what a big thing this is. Jayant, why don't you go first? A book that you would recommend to everybody?
I would definitely go with Michael Lewis, one of the greatest gifted writers of our time. His book, The Big Short, captures most of the action, what happened during the crisis, the actors both on the Main Street as well as on the Wall Street. Movie, I'll probably go with the Inside Job documentary.
That's an Oscar-winning documentary that essentially covered what happened during the crisis. Terrific film if you want it broken down into layman terms. Same with Big Short. Great.
Yes.
Book if you want it broken down into layman terms. Nobody breaks it down into layman terms
better than Michael
better
Lewis.
Than the one and only Michael Lewis.
Oh, easy. Well, The Big Short is the first. That's, I'm sure everybody says The Big Short.
The book or the movie?
Both. They're both good. Yeah, Michael Lewis is a great writer. I'd probably do the book first, then the movie.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
The other one I liked was an HBO special called Too Big to Fail.
Yeah.
I think that was the name of it. Let me just look it up real quick. This was with William Hurt.
Yeah. I think that's, again, based on the book Too Big to Fail. By.
Yeah, that's the movie, Too Big to Fail. The Big Short is about some of the sort of stories on the ground level. Too Big to Fail is about the Fed, the government, and the bailout, and the head of the banks. So if you watch both of those together, I think you'd have your head around a lot of what happened.
If you ask me, I would recommend the movie called Margin Call. It's a fictionalized account of one overnight scene at an investment bank where they suddenly realize that they have to tell their investors and their customers the next day that they're way short on in terms of the money they were supposed to have, and thanks to their spreadsheet models, suddenly they don't have that money any longer. It might sound like a very technical financial movie, but it isn't, because what it is about the human emotions at play and the high stakes decisions that are involved for a bank, and why this banking and financial sector itself is unique, why these small problems of solvency and liquidity can create such huge crisis. It's a great example to understand.
This is the same movie where the juniors discovered the problem post office working hours.
Yes, exactly. So they discover a discrepancy and they realize that the bank is going to be insolvent the next day, and they tell their higher ups, but in the meantime the bank has already fired the risk officer. And the funniest thing about it is the bank chairman comes in and he says that, explain to me all of this like you would explain to a 5-year-old child or a golden retriever.
No wonder the movie name is Margin Call.
Most of the remainder of the movie is about explaining this stuff to him in the simplest possible terms that a golden retriever could understand. Watch it for the performances, watch it for the great story and an exploration of human emotions. And of course, if you talk about a book, there's a terrific book by Joan Ocera and Bethany McLean, which is called All the Devils Are Here. As the name suggests, it talks about how the crisis originated. Where does so this whole financial crisis, how its origins lay in the housing market and why that happened. And as the name suggests, All the Devils Are Here, taken from a line in a Shakespeare play, that basically it is everybody's fault, and they talk about everybody whose fault it was. So you could watch those, and to borrow a phrase from Radhika, remain risk conscious.
Yes.
So that would be the one lesson we'd probably tell you to take home from 10 years from this crisis, and maybe 10 years into the future. Who knows where the next crisis might loom, but that should not necessarily catch you off guard.
Yeah, you better be ready.
That's right. As that famous Cypress Hill song goes, when the shit goes down,
you better be ready.
Alright, that's all the time we have for our very special episode. A huge, huge thanks to all the guests who came on and spoke about their own experiences. Shout out to Radhika, Saurav, Eric and Lovai, who were kind enough to give us their time to be interviewed and kind enough to share their insights and their first-hand experiences about what was going on. Hope you guys found it interesting and helpful. If there's anything else you'd like to hear about, please let us know. Thank you for all the feedback on the first episode. We will try and incorporate all the feedback that has been coming in, and thank you for all those who appreciated the show as well. Please go ahead and rank us and rate us on Google Podcasts, on iTunes. Please leave us a review. You can also find us on Pocket Cast, or you can visit our blog, it's themarket.wordpress.com, or you can visit us on Twitter at The Economist, Economist with an R. Jen, is there anything you want to plug?
Well, you better rate us and share the feedback. And please write in to us if you have any specific queries. We'll try to answer them.
We'll try to answer as many as we can, or we'll bring in experts to answer them like we did for this episode.
Yes.
And hope you enjoyed taking this journey with us. Next time, we'll see you on Economics with a new topic and a new episode soon. In the meantime, this is Tariq signing off.
And this is Jayant signing off. See you guys.
And remember, guys, it's Economics mixed spelled with an X.
I bought a house in 2006. My first condo I bought in 2006. And I remember calling the mortgage broker or to get my loan. And she's going, oh, yeah, it cost $170, but it'll probably be $300 in a couple years. I remember her saying that. And that the lesson I learned there was, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.